Okay, recording is going. Here we are. Okay, we're official now. I'm Pat Stevens in Penang, Malaysia, speaking here with a good friend and longtime colleague, Gavin Dudney. And did I get the pronunciation correct?
It's Dudney, but don't worry because Dudney. I've heard so many combinations over the years.
Yes. Well, as many times as we've met, I should have internalized that. But anyway, so it is the 29th of July, 2020. And let's see, we're in Learning Together, episode 481. I've been going great guns with these. Been doing something called Talon, Teaching and Learning in Isolation. And this is the 35th webinar in that, which we started obviously in about March, I think the end of March. So since March, April, May, June, and almost through July, in 4 months, we've done 35 episodes, which is not bad. And so, yeah, that's where we are. So Gavin made a post on Facebook, something to the effect that, I liked what you said. I guess I should probably put this up on screen share as well.
I'm going to look at it in a minute, so no worries.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're waiting for people to turn up. I presume you want to populate the room before you go into
We can wait for a little while. It's just, do you think we've picked a really bad time?
Not necessarily. My events are typically from starting at noon GMT through now. So some of them start at 10 o'clock. I noticed that people in the United States seem to have this time as well. This is 10 o'clock in New York, 10 o'clock in the morning. And maybe a little late for people over in Australia. But let's see, in 1400 UTC, that's another 4 hours over to Japan, so it's probably so 2 a.m. for them, I suppose.
Right.
But anyway, for people in Europe, where you are right now, it's kind of an odd time. It's either 9 or 11. I can't remember how that goes.
This is 3 o'clock in the afternoon for me.
3 o'clock in the afternoon. Yes, of course, 1400.
Which is between dog walks, so ideal.
Yeah. See, a lot of people have trouble getting straight. I don't know how did you go off on the time, because the UK time being out of sync at this particular moment for half a year.
Yeah,
it's
always a bit problematic that this period, because people get confused about the two times fairly easily. And then people never know whether GMT is actually UK time or not UK time. And
they just think it is, don't they? Let me just do a screen share as long as it's just messing around here.
Sure.
And that'll take it over from you, but you can just put it right back. Let's see. Here's my share screen. I'll just show you. Okay. I'm going to stop your screen share. You don't mind, I hope.
No worries.
Okay. And here, as long as we're recording, we'll just put this on the recording. This is what I put up about your event. And you started off on your Facebook post that I responded to, which instigated this. Oh, here's Lane Marshall. How are you, Lane?
Hi, Lane.
We were just talking about SOFLA. Can hardly talk about anything else these days.
I'm sorry. I'm kind of eating breakfast and...
Okay, no worries. We're just getting started. So anyway, I was just showing Gavin his post. He said, as I said here, I'd take an online stir-fry class over a pointless tool any day of the week. Typical Gavin there. But, you know, as long as you're doing online stir classes.
I saw you posted that earlier.
Okay, yeah. So this is something that Paul Seedhouse published in one of my recent edited articles in the Tesla EJ. Sorry about the sirens in the background. I guess they're hauling away some more COVID victims. Anyway, middle of the night here. Anyway, yes, so Paul has developed something called Lingua Cuisine. And it's an app. It's free. And basically, it gets people learning from each other how to cook. And it's got a lot of support about ingredients in many different languages. So you could have people in different, with different native languages who could then figure out what the ingredients were in their different cuisines, you know, in their different versions of them, their different recipes. So the thing that, you know, this is obviously not a tool that's looking for a class. You know, this is an idea. He supports this. And if you read the article, he supports it. Here, I'll show it to you. Here's his article.
I really like the graphics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is where it comes from. But that's how it works. And I show you, he's got three pictures here. This shows a little of the support there is. They've trialed this on people in their own situation and tested it out on them. And so the idea is that you take something that people like to do and you throw in all the sounds and the scrolling down this last one here, all the tastes and the sounds and the smells and the touches and all that stuff that makes language real. And, add it to cuisine, learn from each other, share culture. And our fourth person has just come into the room. So anyhow, I don't know. You have something you're going to talk to us about, but I thought, what's wrong with that or what's right with that? You know, so there's, I think it's a right approach. No,
nothing wrong with that. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me go ahead and grab the screen back if you like.
Okay. All right.
And hi to Lorena.
Hi, Lorena. So we're a small but select group at the moment.
Absolutely.
That's the way I like it. So I kind of plan to just talk for about 10 or 15 minutes and then leave the rest for discussion. I know there aren't that many of us in here, so feel free to interrupt me at any point. But I wanted to put a little context around the bits that Vance posted in the wiki. So that's me. That's my alter ego.
That's a good one.
It's a friend's daughter who does caricatures from photographs. And actually, she got me down. Well, I think I've put on a bit more weight since then. But anyway, so I wanted to put a bit of context around this. And first, I wanted to go back a little bit in history. Back maybe, I don't know, 8 years or more. And I think with the rise of Facebook and Twitter, we were constantly bombarded by these kind of posts for about 3 or 4 years. You know, 28 uses of Twitter in the ELT classrooms, 35 uses for word clouds in the ELT classroom, and all those kind of things. And I have to confess, at the time, I was quite excited about all those. We were going through a really big period of change then. Lots of new tools, lots of new things coming along. And I've always thought that we were, in English language teaching, we're really good at looking at tools that weren't made for us and making them work for us. And I kind of like that. So as the slide says, forgive me, friends, for I too have sinned. I've spent a lot of time in the past reading these articles, maybe even writing some. I had a blog for a long, long time. And then one day I accidentally deleted it all and realized that I didn't care. So I stopped blogging. but I used to indulge in all this. And I do remember at the time, Scott Thornbury, who's one of certainly one of the UK's greatest writers in the language field, he was very exercised by these kind of articles and blog posts. And he said that we were concentrating too much on the tools and not enough on the pedagogy. And this came back to me a little bit when COVID hit in March. Pretty much most countries, I think the UK is a great example, but we all did it. I think teachers were told on Friday afternoon, go home and teach all your classes online starting on Monday. And there was a huge, huge panic at the time. I think everyone was pretty stressed about it all. And I remember there were two kinds of Facebook posts that I noted over the the first week. The first kind was people just saying, I've had a class, I did a class and it was okay, thank God for that. I survived my first online class ever and it wasn't a disaster. And then there was a section of our community, the technology community, who I thought were being a little bit kind of, perhaps a bit overzealous about tools and things, but also a little bit kind of critical about what was happening at the time. And that was when I wrote the Facebook post that Vance refers to. I've just referenced it a little bit up here. It was about some of the EdTech community telling teachers that they couldn't just go and teach online, you know, that it was a big skill, that there were specialists in this field and that you can't just do it. And I remember thinking, well, actually, you can just do it, because at the very basic level, all you need to do, and this is what I recommended, was buy some sticky whiteboard paper, which you can get in most countries, stick it on the wall of your bedroom or your office, and use Zoom to just carry on teaching the way you were teaching. Move around, write things on the board, talk to people. And that would actually be a really good start and actually maybe stop the panic. And usually my Facebook posts are read by about 5 people, and 2 of those actually live with me. And this post was read, liked by 799 people, shared by 381. And so I thought it obviously struck a chord. Now, I don't think that is it, because I think online teaching is different. And that if you're going to do it long term, if you're going to do it well, then it does require some skills, some extra skills. And it also requires more than Zoom or more than a synchronous platform. It also requires an asynchronous platform as well. And this struck a chord with lots of people, I think. Here's some typical comments. I'm afraid there are so many apps and extra online resources being flung here and there that it can be really overwhelming for the teacher. Keep it simple. And I thought that was really good advice. Most teachers were given zero or little training, also true. And the stress on many to suddenly be a tech whiz is unfair and unreasonable. Everyone's inundated with how to techify guides and videos as though the technology overrides pedagogy and content. It's just a support. Sit back, breathe, one step at a time. Hang in there, everybody. Couldn't have put it better myself. And then I noticed in some of the comments, this is a comment that really struck me as not being helpful. And it says, my complaint from the beginning is that we've taken some of the best classroom teachers and ask them to replicate a classroom on Zoom. That's not the way it works. You cannot replicate a classroom online, and you shouldn't. You should do so much more. It could be so much better. And it was this kind of comment that I thought must be adding to the stress of teachers who'd just been told to go online. And there was a big discussion on that Facebook post, and there's been big discussions elsewhere of what we should be doing and why we should be doing it. What I've been doing in the last 3 months is I've been sitting in on some classes, online classes, and I've also been interviewing teachers who were not online teachers before and not big technology fans. And I want to show you some examples from a school. These are all taken from the same school. They're taken from a school called IH Torun, which is in Poland. It's an international house school. And I started noticing that what they were doing was really interesting. They weren't doing these fancy online classes with Kahoot and Quizlet and all these kind of things. What were they doing? They were cooking. This was a young teacher called Nicola, absolutely fabulous class. She took her laptop into her kitchen in her flat and she cooked a stir fry while she taught her students. So, you know, the usual things, boil, grate, stir fry, marinade, slice, all those kind of things. Brilliant, brilliant class. Absolutely fabulous idea, I thought. And it involved nothing but Zoom, and most importantly, a really, really good teacher. And a teacher who knew how to get the best out of a really difficult situation. And I'm concentrating on this school because it's just the one that I know really, really well from the examples I've seen. Here's another thing. a junior class where they were making mythical creatures out of modeling clay or plasticine. But the one thing that strikes me if you look at the people is just how engaged they are. Again, no tools, just Zoom. Another class, they invited a famous whistleblower, Catherine Gunn, to attend their class and interviewed her. She was the subject of a film called Official Secrets. Her character was played by Keira Knightley in the film. So he managed to convince this woman to come into one of his Zoom sessions and talk to his students. And then this is Nicola, the woman who did the stir fry, working with a lot of really young learners, producing chocolate Easter nests. And all the kids made them at home with the teacher giving instructions. And to me, that really exemplified what good online teaching is, I thought. I thought they were great examples. They weren't complex. They weren't asking people to take on a bigger challenge of bringing in other external tools, creating accounts, trying things out, failing, all those kind of things. And the thing about tools is that people like us, I think, we technology fanatics, we get utterly obsessed with them. We're constantly obsessed. And I know this because I run training sessions every year, both online and usually face-to-face. And I do introduce teachers to some tools in those sessions. But I also make a point of saying that I don't think they're that important. But I can guarantee you, if I introduce 20 tools over 3 weeks, that when my teachers get home, if I ask them to do a mind map of all the tools they've used and how often they've used them, it would look a bit like that. Yeah, you're not supposed to read those. It says other tool. So the teachers, you give them a tool, they become obsessed with it. Kahoot's a great example. They use it in every lesson or Quizlet. And then there's some other stuff. But to go back to those examples, I thought their elegance and their impact was in their simplicity. That's what I really, really liked about them. So that's where we got to. And it's been called emergency online teaching. It's been called all sorts of other things. So where are we now? Well, I think we're at a really interesting point because here in the Northern Hemisphere, we're just going into the summer holiday period, or we're in the summer holiday period. And students won't be going back until late August, early September. And I think there's still a vague aim that all students will be going back in September, at least into state education. I don't know about the private language schools. My feeling is that they probably won't. And if you look at the private language school sector, my feeling is that there'll be a group of students who have studied online for the last 3-4 months who will want to carry on studying online. They won't want to go back to the old system. Because one of the other things that's happened, I think, is that students who traditionally would have thought, I don't want to study online or online studying is awful, have actually found out it's all right. And some of them will want to carry on doing it. And teachers who also thought that online teaching was rubbish have actually had some really positive experiences. And interviewing teachers for a little research project, a lot of the teachers that I've spoken to have been really pleasantly surprised at the level of engagement online, the attendance, the amount of work people have done, and all those kind of things. So I think we might see a hybrid model, some people in classes, socially distanced, and some people at home. A nightmare for the teacher, that's for sure. Whichever way you look at that, I think. I've nearly finished. I just want to say a couple of things. None of this is about the tools, I think. There's a link to a blog post there, which Vance has already linked to. The future looks kind of shaky for education, I think. It looks shaky in terms of attendance, and it looks shaky in terms of what happens to teachers and the amount of work they have. And I don't think there's any denying that. We're seeing now in Europe, they're talking of a second wave. I don't think we've actually got rid of the first one yet, but clearly it's coming back. It's going to continue to come back until we find some kind of vaccine. So we've got this period of uncertainty, and I think, I don't think teachers should be worrying about the tools. What I think they should be worrying about is online skills, teaching skills, not tools, skills. So I think, firstly, for every synchronous platform, there needs to be an asynchronous platform. It's not enough to just have Zoom, because Zoom is a very ephemeral thing. Even with recordings, people come to sessions, they go home, and that's it. What an asynchronous platform like Moodle or Edmodo or whatever will allow you to do is to provide some structure around those live sessions and allow people to do other things, to track their progress, to do some exercises, et cetera, et cetera. So what I think we need is we need training, not tools. Training for teachers about how to teach online, about how to combine synchronous and asynchronous platforms, about how to measure progress, about how to cope with assessment, and all those kind of things. But I think the last thing people need at the moment is a mad collection of tools and 300 or 400 ways of using them. So that was basically, that's it. That was the premise of the Facebook post and of the blog post. I think, you know, we need to support teachers, and the way to support teachers is to give them the confidence to do what they're going to have to do and not to pummel them with tools, attractive as they may be. That's it. So,
well, anybody... You're certainly preaching to the converted here.
Yes, I know. It's a bit of a shame coming to this kind of group to talk about this, but there you go.
No, but that's why I'm here, because I am working to try to get the same point across. In fact, I've been, I should probably turn on my camera for talking, I guess.
Yay.
I haven't seen myself today. Oh, good Lord. Oh, well, it's all right. Just friends. Okay. I have a presentation called Online Pedagogy. It's not just tech tools. And when I go in there, I say, you know, if you're here to learn about tools, that's not what we're going to talk about. But, you know, you're so right about the fact that we get obsessed. And not only we get obsessed, I mean, I got excited about Miro just a few weeks ago. Uh-huh. And I'm like, Miro, my new best friend. And I used it right away but that's us. We can control that. What is harder to control is that teachers want tools. And invariably in the chat, while I'm presenting, everyone's talking about tools. Oh, did you try this? Have you seen that?
Uh-huh.
And they are obsessed with the tools because tools, I think the reason they have this obsession is that tools are concrete. They're something that they can learn and use and say, okay, I can teach online because I use Kahoot. You know, and it sort of solves their problem.
Mm.
They avoid looking at the deeper issues that you're talking about when you listed how to do the training just now.
Yeah, maybe it means you don't have to think so much about the pedagogy if you've got a lot of tools. I run a master's module every summer, face-to-face. This year it's been online. And there are various themes that run through the 2 weeks. But one of the themes is mobile learning, which is a big favorite of mine. And every year, at the end of the day and a half we spend on mobile learning, everyone asks, are you not going to give us a list of apps? And I go, no, I'm not going to give you a list of apps. Because you don't need the apps. I mean, mobile phones are brilliant. They take photographs, they make videos, they make audio recordings. You can read things, you can listen to things. There's millions of things you could do on a mobile phone without an app. And I, you know, this obsession with lists of apps and tools, I think is extremely unhealthy amongst us and the people we spend time with, but it's distinctly unhelpful for all the new online teachers, I think, who are just surviving well, many of them. That young woman I showed, Nicola, who did the stir fry and the chocolate nests and things, she's been doing some amazing stuff, and it's been absolutely brilliant. And it's just good teaching.
Well, it's interesting because I'm coaching my faculty at the college where I work. And some of them, you mentioned, what you were talking about was using essentially synchronous only and relying on that. I had one faculty member like that, but I also had others who were not interested in any synchronous at all. They just wanted to do asynchronous. So I had both. And what I found was each individual faculty member, I had to work with them separately and discover what's their teaching style, what's their subject matter, what are their inclinations, and then I had to develop kind of instructional design. I had to develop what online teaching would look like for them. And it looked completely different for every single faculty member. My dean had asked me originally, she said, why don't you do a workshop? This is, by the way, I'm just faculty. I am not a tech. I'm just a faculty member who has learned technology. But she said, why don't you do a workshop and just teach them all how to do it? And I explained to her that, you know, they're cats. They're cats.
Don't get them that easy.
Yeah, so I've been meeting with them. In fact, I'm meeting with one later, but I have to meet with them individually and work with them individually. There's no one way, you know, how do you teach online? Well, how do you teach? Who are you? And then you construct it for them individually, which is very labor intensive. And that's an issue that I'm exploring is there any way to make this a little less labor intensive than what I'm doing?
Yeah, in my professional life, in the paid work, we're currently working with two different sets of or groups of people. I think the first group are schools that just want their teachers to be taught how to do good things in Zoom. So we're doing quite a lot of Zoom training, if you like, and sample classes, that kind of stuff, so people can see it. And then there are probably larger organizations who are trying to plan and think more strategically. So they're looking beyond the panic or the survival to this could go on for a long time. You know, it could come back. If it doesn't come back, something else will come along. And we're probably entering into a period where we may have to move constantly and smoothly between online and face-to-face. You know, with local lockdowns, which we now have in the UK, you may have to say, look, all your classes are going online next week for the following 3 weeks, and then we'll be back in class. And so I think organisations need to prepare for that kind of journey in and out of lockdown and what that's going to look like. So the bigger organisations are maybe ones that didn't have, but they're beginning to now want to adopt an asynchronous platform like Moodle or something to be able to plan and move their curriculum into a proper blended space where they can do that kind of in and out of lockdown thing. And that's interesting because, as you've just said, everyone's different and every school is different and they all have totally different needs. So you can't just plan this kind of work and deliver it to different people. It's got to be, you know, it's proper kind of deep sort of consultancy work, I think, where you're spending time with people.
Well, every teacher is different. All the students are different. And
totally.
So, but you're going to intersect, you know, so, and also if you're engaging, you can win people over to your side. So, I mean, if it were me, I would spend a lot of time in Minecraft. I mean, I wouldn't spend all my time, but I would go there every now and then. That's just something I like to do, and I find it useful for language learning. But anyway, what I have been doing in my classes, because I haven't been allowed to go into Minecraft where I was last working, motorcycles out. I would set up blended environments. And so you're talking about the synchronous and the asynchronous. I've always been preparing something that that bases my class, and also makes you think, as you said, it makes you think about your pedagogical strategy. Because if you actually set it out on a wiki or in a Moodle or Schoology or something like that, it actually has to hang together. Mm. So that's quite important. And also in this, in part of this Talon thing, well, I got into this because in January and February I was doing courses on blended learning for English language specialist program. And so I was teaching, they wanted me to do sessions on blended learning and not just the same thing over and over again, but I had to set up 4 hours of this and then approach it differently with the different people I would meet for one day. But then when we got into the online part of it, we started setting up what became the Talon webinars, really. And Jeff LeBeau came to one. You know Jeff LeBeau?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a teacher in Korea who is also famous for his world bridges and Korea bridges, all the different communities he set up doing webcasting. He was a pioneer in this kind of thing. And he's been, now he's in Korea and he's been using this with his students. One of the things he does is he has them teach cooking. So he gets them all in sessions like this and has them, what are we doing here? Where are we going?
I'm trying to stop my camera going.
Hold down, it's going too fast.
I'm trying to stop my camera going in and out of focus. I've got no idea why it's doing it, but it's really annoying. Well, it's annoying me, so it must be annoying you guys.
Well, the point is that what Jeff is doing, what I've been doing in normal classes, doing blended learning, or what I call blended learning, or you can also call it, what's the other term for it? I don't call it that.
Hybrid.
Yeah? Hybrid. Thank you. Hybrid learning. Doing that in classes that you meet face-to-face, you've already got your foot in the skill set that you need to take it online. And so Jeff has actually been setting up hybrid blended experiences for his whole college. And then when they suddenly decided on Friday that they had to start on Monday doing online, it wasn't a big leap. You know, so I think in a way that's kind of the secret. You're less daunted if you've already been doing things online, meeting people face-to-face. You have to replace the face-to-face now with something that's engaging in Zoom or however you do it. Other options as well. Maybe we should ask Lorena what she thinks about all this.
I find it extremely interesting. I've been following in-person sessions when I was in the UK. We moved temporarily to Ireland because we were in lockdown and we had a place in Southwest Ireland. We do own a small house. 20 years ago, we started building this house and it's our safe place to be. And it feels so safe, so good. I can't explain. We are remote, but we have internet. I think you can hear me well, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, good internet. Yeah, I mean, we're really far from any civilization, which is wonderful. We have our own well, you know, we have water, we have solar panels. So it feels like it's the place to be at the moment. In London, we live in central London. We have been home educating for 3 years, our daughter. So it's no change. In fact, our daughter is thriving in learning since the lockdown because there was a need. And when there is a need, children learn more. There is a point, you know, it's why they're learning. So she's running her own Zoom sessions for children, and that's been really interesting because they're learning how to host sessions. And they bring topics, which is very similar with that school, Gavin, you were talking about, is doing. They're doing cooking. They're doing a lot of games, of course, Minecraft. They're experts. But they host, and the idea was of the project is to collaboratively create a list of do's, you know, what to do to host really well. And it's very similar what you've been doing. Saying today, witness, if you said keep it simple, that was one of the tips when child said after hosting. Another said, I mean, they are 6 to 12 years old. Another said, have a backup plan. We learned that quite quickly. Yeah. Another said, take notes so that you can time it properly. And the last one said, you need to time it, otherwise either it's too short or too long. It's been an amazing. The last session is this Thursday. We voted the community where 25 families. It's something I really wanted to keep learning over August, but we do need a break. So we are just reorganizing the learning, and this next Thursday is going to be a 10-minute slot, so every child can bring their own topic. They will be hosting for 10 weeks, and we'll move on. I mean, for me, following the sessions, advances, coordinator organizing for years, it's been so good because I had, you know, I was every week actually listening to the recordings while I was moving home and... for me, this is the future. I feel so comfortable. What I see some of the facilitators that do the sessions, I mean, we are based in Rada, in the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in Rada. It's a home education group, and it's not curriculum-based. It's interest-based. So it's a new project I'm coordinating. And this blended side is really worked for us beautifully. So a lot of kids didn't like online, and they love it now. Because I think we work with Andrew Tidmarsh, who is a film director. He's running the drama session, so he worked on the camera first. So he did a lot of exercise on how to follow the, you know, the camera with a finger, a lot of things. And after that, then he just let the children do whatever they like, basically, and support the storytelling. And from that, we're moving into... Graham Stanley, I have been following his recordings. I'm hoping that my nephew will start storytelling, that kind of model soon. Right. But for me, it's been all of this. I mean, today your session, Gavin, I participated in your courses and in moderation 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And for me, meeting you in person is like,
I know,
wow.
I recognize the name.
Do you? But at those times we were in like chat boxes, it was so good. It's become too, it's not very inclusive because some families don't can't afford a computer, you know, that, for instance, the fancy background that children really like, and sometimes they can't do it because the computer is too old.
Yeah.
So it's become too fancy, you know, the amount of tools used. We're very simple. I think you're completely, you know, I mean, you're an expert, of course, you know. But for me, it's reassuring that you're confirming all these, you know, that we have experience. Well, yes.
Let's say hi to Carla. And hey, also, Carla. In the Facebook chat, we have Jane Sheehan and Helen Galani. Maybe
friend.
Some other people there.
Lots of interesting things, Ella, and thank you. I think the one thing that we didn't mention there, of course, is that many teachers who have been doing this fabulous emergency online teaching have also been homeschooling their own kids.
Yay.
And I think, you know, juggling all that during the day must have been a real proper challenge. You know, I mean, I all I have is a dog that needs a walk three times a day, and I'm kind of in control of that. So in that respect, it hasn't affected my life at all. But I do think some people have been under extraordinary stress from a variety of different things. So it's not just stress from folks like us telling them about loads of wonderful tools, but also, you know, just keeping the family together and all that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, those teachers who have survived this with some kind of sense of humour intact have done very, very well, because I think it's been an extremely challenging period.
I see that Miguel Mendoza is with us as well.
Oh, lovely Miguel. Hey, hi Miguel.
So, Carla, how's it going? I'm not really sure what you're doing exactly now that you've moved from Casa Thomas Jefferson.
She's doing loads of amazing stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're here trying to, you know, do some, well, helping teachers to go through all this period. And I read Gavin's article, blog post about, you know, the talk today. I couldn't come earlier, but I read it and was really interested because it's the same approach that we feel here, that it's working with teachers in Brazil. Teachers, they get lists of tools and stuff, and it doesn't help much if they don't know what to do with those tools. So I think we are doing similar jobs in different parts of the world. I think in the webhead spirit more than ever. I think what we've been talking about for, I don't know, more than a decade or 20 years. I think it is making sense for people that we've been trying to preach for so long. And it seems like the webhead spirit now is everywhere and people want to understand what we've been talking about for so long. So I think that the main thing with teachers now is not the what, the tools, but how to, yeah? So how can I survive and move from this emergency period? And I guess that we are getting there. Things are normalizing and accommodating in some way. And teachers feel that now they need something else, like, okay, I've been through all that. I've been here for 4 months, 5 months in emergency mode, trying to survive with my kids, with, you know, my kids online, my kids at home, mm-hmm. what Gavin was saying. And now it's a matter of really, some of them are really into taking that step further, like what can I do now to feel safe and to move from this emergency period in terms of the, professional development and that. And I think that's where Gavin is, where I am, and many webheads are, I guess.
I think we called it from surviving to thriving, you know, from actually just being able to hold on to it for a while, to actually getting up and going, do you know what? I can do this. You know, yes. I've got the tools and the skills.
Yeah. And then, like, it's the great reset that the World Economic Forum talked about. And I think that's the greatest chance for teachers to really consider this reset in terms of retooling. And then what do I do from there? Yeah, I think... it's an amazing time. It's hard, but it's really, the world has stopped for us to learn that things are digital. There is no way out. So
I think it's stopped for us to learn all sorts of things. You know, it's kind of interesting watching the dialogue around things like conferences and flying to other countries for meetings and all those kind of things in the light of the climate crisis. And not being able to do it has made a lot of people realize that actually they don't have to do it, which has been interesting. We've had, I think, well, certainly in my house, we've re-examined our relationship with shops and who we buy from. You know, we bought a lot more local food, local butchers and local fishmongers and things like that. So it's had an impact on a variety of things. There is a danger, of course, that we just slide back into doing what we've always done as soon as it's possible. But hopefully education's a bit more adventurous than that, maybe.
I hope in London we won't do that, because London is not a nice place, you know, with all the contamination. I mean, during the lockdown, London was a paradise. The air was clean, we could hear the birds singing through the window. And it's just not a nice place, and everyone agrees with that. But now I could see people getting back to normal too quickly, and I was concerned about that. You know, I hope we won't come back to the normality in London. You know, I don't know where you based, Gavin. Are you?
I'm just outside Swansea in Wales.
Swansea! Oh my goodness, that's fantastic.
So I live in I actually live quite near the city, but I live in a tiny row of 10 cottages. Not all of them. I only live in one of them, with fields behind and in front of us. So it kind of feels like the countryside, but it's only 15 minutes to the city.
That's wonderful. My family comes from Mumbles.
The posh part.
Welsh, my husband. Yes. It's a gorgeous place of the world. I love Wales. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you're fine then.
They don't allow us poor people into the Mumble.
Well, yeah. So you're speaking about going back to where we were. You mentioned in your article, and also I think earlier, that some of the practicalities of going back to, I've heard a lot, language school owners are quite concerned because, you've got to get people into your school if you're going to survive. And that's quite a lot to cope with.
My history there is in the private language school sector, obviously not the state system. Mm-hmm. And the private language school system has always had a fairly tough time at making money. I mean, you need high occupancy in what are traditionally, at least in Europe, small classrooms. They're usually small classrooms with lots of people in them, and you need something like 80% occupancy all the time you're open in order to make some profit and things like that. So clearly that's going to be a challenge. It's also, I mean, there's a difference between running a private language school in Barcelona where all your clients are local, or running one in London where all your clients are coming from other countries, generally.
Or not coming from other countries.
So, I mean, it's going to be a challenge. And one of the things that people are talking about is this, again, people are using the term hybrid, of basically assuming that there will be some people who will be in the physical classroom and they'll be socially distant. So there's probably going to be 6 people instead of 15. And then some people will be online somewhere and they'll be beamed into the classroom via screens and things like that. And I've got to say, from a teaching point of view, that sounds like hell to me for all sorts of reasons. Technical issues. We know, if you've ever been in a meeting, a face-to-face meeting, where some people were online, you'll know how quickly the online people are forgotten about.
Yeah, I had to do that once, and I had 2 groups, the faraway group and the in-person group. And what I found, I don't know if other people find the same thing, but what I found was that I could either relate to one group or the other. And so sometimes I would get very engaged with the online people, and then I forget that there are people right in front of me. I would completely forget that. And then the reverse would happen. I don't see a good pathway for that model.
No, and I actually think it's probably the only model that makes economic sense to private language schools, because their clientele are going to be reduced, but they're going to be fragmented as well. It's going to be, a terrible time for lots of private language schools. State education, my guess is that most governments are just going to force kids to go back, and that will be it. And, whatever, what will be, will be. That's certainly the approach in the UK. Everyone's going back in September, basically. And then we'll see what happens. And it doesn't sound good. It doesn't sound like a sensible approach to me. I think, I've seen brilliant online teaching. When Graham Stanley was down in Uruguay running the Plan Ceval, I went there and, we actually did some teacher training for that project, but I went and watched some of those classes from remote teacher booths, which were no bigger than my current desk. And it was magical. It was magical teaching. And within 5 minutes, you forgot you were sitting in a tiny booth in Uruguay and that you weren't in the school. You just forgot, because the remote teachers and the face-to-face teachers were brilliant. And it was fabulous. We know it works. But what we don't know is I don't think this hybrid model is a brilliant one, and I think it's going to cause lots of problems. So I would expect the private language school sector, at least in the UK, to shrink by 50% probably.
Wow.
Yeah, and we've already seen schools closing in the same way that we've already seen famous theatres closing, famous bars and restaurants and all these kind of things. This is just, it's just a very odd period, and we're kind of lucky. I think I certainly know that Nikki, my business partner, and I are as busy as ever, because for once in our life we're doing something that everybody wants.
Also, you're good at what you do.
Thank you. My first post on Facebook was, I've spent 25 years trying to teach teachers to teach online, and then this upstart COVID comes along and changes their minds in 2 weeks.
That's the same thing that happened to me. I was marginalized by my faculty. Oh, she's that one that teaches online.
The weird one. Yeah.
Teaching is about relationships and warmth and all. And they don't understand. They think, you know, but now they want to talk to me.
Well, this is our time now. I mean, I'm sorry it came because of a global pandemic, but someone's got to be there to sort it all out, haven't they? And that's what we're for, I think, you know. I think we can help people, you know, and certainly the work that Nikki and I are doing with organisations is really interesting and fulfilling, you know, and just helping people get beyond that.
So I have a question for you. I did a survey of some of my teachers, and mm-hmm. this was not the faculty members now, these are classroom teachers. And they, I said to them, what's your most pressing issue? What are you most worried about as you go to online teaching? And of course, everyone had, you know, their own take on it. But the most common answer was to have engagement by the students, for them to really be engaged and not just really thinking about their surroundings at home and things like that. These are kids. So the idea is how to keep them engaged. And I wondered, if you know, how do you approach this issue of student engagement online?
When you say kids, how old are we talking?
Well, K-12, you know.
Okay.
I mean, all teachers, language teachers, ESL teachers in the K-12 public schools of the U.S., if you, you know.
Right. I mean, some of those projects that I looked at briefly in the quick presentation I did, I think were brilliant examples of engagement. Carla, this was an international house school in Poland, and they've been doing really amazing stuff remotely. They haven't been doing grammar exercises and things. They've been doing cooking a stir fry with your teacher and making models, and they've done. And it's that kind of stuff that works. I've also observed, just because I was interested in what other people were doing, there's obviously a load of remote teaching that goes on in China and has been going on for quite some time, particularly with kids, because parents want their Chinese kids to get that kind of competitive advantage. And there's a massive industry in the US providing online teachers to those Chinese schools. And I've observed some of them as well. And that's been kind of interesting, because they do exactly what you would do in a normal class. There's a lot of there's a lot of realia, there's a lot of jumping around, there's a lot of singing, there's a lot of finger puppets, there's a handheld whiteboard, and all the kind of things that you would imagine work. But for me, the IH Torun activities were brilliant, because they had a linguistic aim, but they also they did do things that you couldn't do face-to-face, because you couldn't cook a stir-fry with your students in a language school. But they didn't rely on any tools at all. They just relied on the brilliant planning of a good teacher. Look, I think if you need to keep people motivated, you've got to get them up and do stuff. But they've got to move around. They've got to create things. They've got to go. If they're locked down in their house, there's got to be opportunities for them to wander around their house and find stuff that's going to be useful in their class. Take a photograph of their bedroom and talk about it. You know, they're tiny little things, but they're things that I think do increase motivation. I bet Carla's got some really good ideas. Go on.
I'm taking notes here, but
me too.
Because I loved what Gavin said, like they didn't rely on tools, but the great lessons, lesson plans that a good teacher can do. So I think this is what we need to tell teachers, that it's just their gut feeling, what they are really doing in their classrooms. But in a way, I think that the main thing about engagement is that what I feel the most successful classes in remote learning is when the teacher get this feeling of, you know, I have this lesson plan here. How can I integrate with what kids have in their homes? When they can do that, bring the context of remote learning, really thinking about remote and then the learning part, this is where magic happens. And that's what I've seen, like, from teachers that I know that are in different situations. And one thing that I think that is also important is to understand what didn't work that we can just, you know, dump it. We don't need to do it anymore. So for example, I can understand that the first stage is like substitution. So if I had a board, I really need the board and write on the board. But then when you realize that this is not engaging for the students and it was not in class, then I think magic starts to happen. And I see that from my kids. I had my youngest here, he was in his senior year. Can you imagine? It's the best year ever.
Yeah.
And then the school decided that they were going to reproduce what was not working in school. So they would have lectures from 7:30 in the morning till midday, like lectures, just reproducing what the kids had. They are 16-year-old kids. They are 15-year-old kids. They couldn't pay attention to that. They couldn't sit still for 5 hours. So in an online environment, they wouldn't do it. They would wake up in the morning, turn on their, the platform there, and then sign in. And then they would turn off their cameras and would, you know, be chatting on WhatsApp or going back to sleep. That's what we did. So then we talked to my kid and he decided to anticipate. We had to go to court to have an authorization so that he could enroll in a college. And that's where we got to this point. Why? Because teachers were trying to reproduce what they knew. And I know the pain that they feel and the burden that they have, because most of administrators just said, go and do it. They didn't know. The leaders didn't know what to do.
Absolutely.
So that's the point. But then when I see those teachers that they feel they start substituting and then they move on to the next step in the sense that realizing that now they have everything that they couldn't do before, that's when we get student engagement.
Interestingly, I think this is, you know, Scott Thornbury's famous dogma teaching unplugged approach actually works in this situation perfectly. It's about the people in the room, whether that room is physical or virtual, and making use of people as resource works brilliantly in a Zoom room like this. You know, a bit of paper stuck on the wall behind you, and just simple things can work magic. I think we don't need to overcomplicate these things. And the more complex they get, the less likely they are to engage, I think, in a way. If you've got
people... We can now have our pets in the classroom. We could never do that. Kids' pets could never be in the classroom. Like
I know, all those things that you can bring to class with you now.
Yes.
I know.
So there's a framework that was presented in one some of the sessions I attended from David Rosen. He's an adult educator in this adult ed in the US. And what he said was that for when you're moving online, you want to look for areas of equivalency where you can do the same thing that you did with minor tweaks. You also want to look at the limitations, things that you're not going to be able to do because there are things like that. And then you want to look at the advantages, like Carla just said, there are advantages because there are things you can do that you couldn't do, those three. And to those three things, which I think is very helpful if teachers can think in those terms. And then, this is David Rosen. And then I added another one to that, which is innovations, things that you never even thought of before that you can do, brand new things that you might be able to kind of change the whole idea of teaching by doing something innovative.
I think what's interesting, to go back to the stir fry class, because I'm a bit obsessed with the stir fry class, because it's one of those elegant ideas that I just think it hits the spot immediately. It is something that you can't do normally, but it just reveals it's such a door into an empathetic learning experience. You know, watching someone cook whilst they're going through some verbs and, you know, chop and it's such a an experience that engenders such empathy that you can't help but learn something from it. It might not be the verbs that she was hoping they learned, but I can guarantee you everyone learned something from that class. A little bit more about their teacher, maybe.
Well, it's a little bit like when you go to live in a country, if you want to learn the language, you don't just go to school to learn. You're in the country, so you're learning, you're living the language. And so it's a little bit like that. Reminds me of that.
I guess also because people were in emergency, that pressure was off the curriculum as well. You know, that people didn't have to finish the syllabus or didn't have to finish the book. All they had to do was survive till the end of term without losing their students, I think. So they could do what they wanted.
That's cool. That's cool.
Maybe
innovation is curriculum a lot of times.
But also, of course, the exams were cancelled because the curriculum is there and the end is the exam, which is more, in the UK, is unfair. It's a system, it's the most socially unfair that is known. But that disappeared, that went, which meant freedom.
And it's not true for the fall, right? And in the fall, it's not true for the fall. Fall, they expect you to be doing the curriculum, right?
Oh, they will. When school goes back, I would expect there to be a 1 or 2 week period in which there'll be a lot of stuff about wellness and that kind of thing to get people back into the system. And then it'll be straight back into the curriculum, yeah. It'll be like this never happened.
But, I mean, the schools have been open, right? They have been open with children that needed support, vulnerable children that needed. Because the schools also feed children, you know. The schools are very important socially for
they are totally. I mean, I think that's the bit that's missing, obviously, is kids playing with kids, chatting to kids.
Yes, I believe it's at the moment open. The schools are open for social contact and for children seeing their friends more than anything else because they have had a very tough time, of course, because of that. Yes, but I don't know in September. I mean, many parents are very concerned about the children catching up. We have an allotment in London, and we do a lot of community there. And I was talking to one of the allotmenteers, and he was saying he had a three-year-old. He said he did 1 hour of English and now 1 hour of maths. Because you never know when that will happen when she comes back to nursery. He thought, what makes you feel that you have to do that? Culture, where we live in Clapham, which is quite a lot of private schooling around.
Yeah.
And these Montessori nurseries actually just academic learning for really competitive. Which is, it really surprised me because, of course, in the home ed community, there's none of that. I mean, there's a mix of people, but competitiveness is not the aim. It's well-being and following your children's interests and engage with whatever your child wants to learn. So more about learning than teaching, what I really experience as a teacher myself. I see a lot of learning happening, but sometimes there's no teaching, but actually the children are still learning.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm going to have to leave you because sadly I've got a really long.
Oh, wow. That was a quick hour.
A long AMA module leaders meeting, which I'm really looking forward to, that starts right now. It's been a pleasure seeing you. Thank you so much. We were a small
Thank you.
Thank you. This
has been great to see you again.
Gavin,
it was great to see you too,
speaking
Carla.
To us tonight.
But yes, thank you ever so much. Stay safe.
My pleasure.
Everyone.
There's a little chat going on in the Facebook. Unfortunately, I don't know how to integrate Facebook with what we're doing here. It's just too many fingers. I need more fingers. But Vicky Sawmill joined us, and also Lillian Simone, I think. Let's see.
Oh, Liliana Simone.
Liliana Simone, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So anyway, and a shout out to those people. And thank you very much, everyone, for coming and enjoying this. And Gavin, thanks for giving us your time. No,
it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much. I wish I could be more active, but sadly the day job and the dog just fill up my time. But I thank you, Vance, for keeping things going.
Cleaning all those tin houses, too, must be a real
inimitable pain.
So, okay.
Thank you both.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll just do a little outro.
Thank you.
Bye.
But we say this is Learning Together, episode 481, and it's the 35th, I can't remember, Talon episode. And nice to see Carla and Lorena, hear from you, and Helene. So nice that you're here. And so Vance Stevens in Penang saying goodbye to everybody. Good night. Thanks a lot for coming.
Good night.
Nice to see you.
Maybe see you next Sunday. We're always around on Sunday at noon UTC. Different place. Just look at learningtogether.net. Sorry, learningtogether.pbworks.com. That's where you find the next thing that's up. Okay. Bye. Let's see. I have to start shutting this down. I think the first thing I'll shut down is Facebook. Goodbye, Facebook. Everyone in the Facebook chat. Let's see. How do I do that? Stop live stream. Okay, it's stopping right now. Carla, really good to see you. Okay. And now the recording, I'm stopping that. The record Facebook, you have to stop it up at the top. The recording, you have to come down on the bottom and do it. So it's stop recording. Okay. Bye, everybody.